Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we take mountains of research and distill it into sharp, practical knowledge for you. Today, we're really getting into it. Emergency transport, ambulances, critical care, medevac flights. You know, it's easy to just think driving fast.
Yeah.
But our sources show it's way more complex. Emergency vehicle operation is, well, it's a highly regulated science, huge personal responsibility, lots of tech involved.
That's spot on. And our mission today really is to unpack all that, the systems, the safety protocols. They're incredibly stringent. We're going to explore that that razor-thin line they walk, balancing the absolute urgency of saving a life with the hard realities of safety, physics, and, yeah, legal liability.
And just to really set the scene on how high the stakes are, this number just jumped out at me from the research. Over 6,500 crashes involving emergency vehicles every year.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, when defensive driving isn't enough, the results are immediate, often severe. It tells you this isn't just about speed. It's about operating in a danger zone every single time they hit the lights and siren.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with the vehicle itself, the actual blueprint. I mean, the units you see now look so modern, state-of-the-art. But the sort of the core design specs, they go back decades. It's fascinating, actually. The first real guidelines came out in the early 1970s.
Right. The Department of Transportation's KKK 1822 specs.
Exactly. KKK 1822 specs. And they updated them, what, every 5 years or so?
They did. But that's 70s origin.
Yeah.
It creates some real challenges today, doesn't it? You've got these original blueprints, but now you need to carry heavy, specialized gear. How do you fit 21st century medical tech onto a chassis spec from the 70s and still, you know, guarantee safety?
It's a huge mismatch. And that's why the whole sector is shifting, looking for new standards. The sources point to two main contenders taking over: the National Fire Prevention Agency, NFPA, and the Commission on Accreditation of Ambulance Services, CAS. This isn't just about looks. It's fundamental structural integrity, patient safety for modern needs.
And those modern needs are driving specialization, too. You mentioned mobile stroke units, pediatric ICUs.
Yeah, those dedicated units.
It's right. They're designed to cut down that critical time between symptom onset and getting advanced care. It's about using technology to beat the clock, not just relying on speed.
So once the vehicle's built to spec, it needs to be equipped.
Mm-hmm.
And every single inch inside is planned out, right? Everything has its place, secured. Organizations like OSHA, the American College of Surgeons, they actually have a say in what supplies need to be carried and locked down.
Absolutely. And ultimately, it falls on the crew before every shift. They're the first checkpoint. They have to ensure the unit's ready to roll, fully supplied, and the mechanical check is crucial, non-negotiable. They talk about the four S's: start, steer, stop, and stay running. Any doubt about those, that vehicle is out of service, period.
Okay, the four S's: start, steer, stop, stay running. Makes sense. So if the unit checks out on paper, how does a driver know during a run if something's going wrong? Are there like key warning signs, the really dangerous ones?
Oh, definitely. There are several. But if you're talking immediate high-risk danger, anything affecting steering or stopping, think about brake fade.
Yeah.
That soft, spongy pedal feel when the brakes overheat means you're losing stopping power.
Right when you need it most.
Exactly. Or something like wheel wobble. That suggests a mechanical failure is coming, making steering unpredictable. You ignore signs like that, you're risking lives instantly.
Okay, so the vehicle has to be perfect, ready to go.
Yeah.
But how do you make sure the right vehicle's in the right place at the right time? That leads us into the whole EMS system structure, which in the U.S. is complex.
It really is. And it varies so much state to state, even county to county. Most first response EMS comes from the fire department, sure, but that's not the only model. You've got public agencies separate from fire, public-private partnerships, private for-profit companies, even nonprofit corporations delivering EMS. It's a real patchwork.
Quite a mix. And with all that variety, efficiency becomes key. That's where system status management, SSM, comes in, right?
Precisely. SSM is all about maximizing efficiency, minimizing response times. It analyzes things like peak call times, historical demand, and then strategically positions ambulances where the next call is statistically most likely to happen.
It's like pre-positioning based on data. They even factor in unit cost, taxpayer subsidies. It's a sophisticated balancing act.
Very much so.
Okay, let's shift focus to the person behind the wheel, the driver. The sources paint a picture of someone needing much more than just fast reflexes. They list things like diligence, caution, being physically and emotionally fit, good judgment. But the one that really stood out to me was tolerance. Tolerance of other drivers.
Ah, yes. That's huge.
In heavy traffic, lights and siren going, time critical, managing your own frustration with unpredictable civilian drivers. That might be the toughest part of the job, psychologically.
Absolutely. And that psychological pressure connects directly to the strict rules about distraction and fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
The list of things you absolutely cannot do while driving is clear. No typing, texting, using personal devices, no music through earbuds, no eating or drinking, full stop.
And fatigue.
If a driver feels fatigue setting in, the guidance is explicit. Place yourself out of service. The risk of impaired judgment is just too high.
That focus on risk carries inside the unit, too.
Yeah.
Securing equipment, you mentioned it earlier, but it's worth stressing. An unsecured monitor, a toolbox, even a backpack. In a sudden stop or a crash, it becomes a projectile. Lethal.
Everything gets locked down. Even the patient needs multiple straps, shoulder restraints. Safety first, always. And that discipline is vital because the legal side is, well, it's unforgiving. Laws differ state by state, of course, but one principle is constant. Emergency drivers get certain limited privileges, like the right-of-way in specific situations. But, and this is critical, those privileges do not reduce their liability if a crash happens.
Wait, hang on. So they can legally, say, go through a red light with lights and siren under the right conditions. But if they hit someone or get hit, they're still potentially liable just like any other driver.
Exactly. The privilege is granted, but the responsibility remains entirely theirs. They must always operate with due regard for the safety of everyone else on the road.
Wow. Due regard. That term carries immense weight then.
It does. It means even when you can legally do something like proceed through that red light, you are still responsible for making absolutely sure it's safe to do so. Check every lane, make eye contact if possible. The onus is on the emergency driver.
That intense responsibility makes you rethink things like siren use. The source has actually called the siren the most overused piece of equipment.
Interesting.
It's only meant for true emergencies, and always with visual warnings, too. Is that misuse just habit, or is it public expectation? People hear an ambulance, they expect noise and speed.
It's probably a combination of factors, training, pressure, perception. But the rule is clear. You don't use sirens just to transport a stable, non-emergency patient faster. And speaking of rules on the road, context changes everything. Escorts, for example, generally discouraged.
Why is that? Seems helpful.
It often just confuses civilian drivers. They don't know who to yield to. If an escort is absolutely necessary, the rule is leave plenty of space and use a different siren tone than the vehicle being escorted.
Okay. And intersections, we know they're high risk. The rule there.
Never accelerate through. Well, slow down. Cover the brake. Check all directions. Make eye contact. Treat every intersection like a major potential hazard.
Makes sense. And some road rules just don't bend, even for emergencies.
Absolutely. School zones, for instance. In many places, exceeding the speed limit is illegal, period. And you never pass a stopped school bus with flashing lights. Never. And funeral processions. Most states give no special exemption. Out of respect, sirens and lights are usually turned off when encountering one.
So pulling it together on vehicle control, the sources say it all boils down to two things: changing direction and changing speed. Drivers have to constantly read the road surface, think about weight, weather, and always maintain that cushion of safety around them because other drivers are unpredictable.
That cushion is vital, and managing the sheer size of these vehicles is key too. Backing up. Always use a spotter. Always. Do a walk around before getting in to check for obstacles. Backup cameras are helpful, sure, but never rely on them alone.
Good point. And finally, when they actually get to the scene, even parking has safety rules.
It does. Park uphill or upwind if there's a hazard like fire or fumes. Stay clear of buildings that might collapse. And crucially, at night. Turn off the headlights once parked. You don't want to blind oncoming traffic or rescue workers.
All right, we've covered the immense precision needed to operate a 15,000-pound truck safely on the ground. But what happens when you add altitude? Let's talk about air medical transport, medevac. The big advantage is obviously speed, right? Getting patients transferred faster.
Speed is the main benefit, yes. But the decision to fly is never taken lightly. The core question is always, does the benefit outweigh the inherent risks of flight? You have to ask, is the patient's condition truly so critical that air transport is warranted? And will it actually save significant time compared to the nearest appropriate ground ambulance?
So it's not automatic, even for serious cases.
Not at all. And the type of aircraft matters too. Rotor wing helicopters, that's the standard for most trauma calls, relatively shorter distances. Fixed wing aircraft, like small planes, are typically for much longer transports, maybe state to state.
And who gets the call for a helicopter? What are the criteria?
Generally, it's when ground transport would simply take too long, maybe because of distance or traffic. or if road access is blocked, like in remote areas or after disasters. Also, if a patient needs highly specialized care only available far away, or if there are multiple casualties that would overwhelm the local hospital. Usually it's for time-critical injuries, severe trauma, things like strokes or heart attacks, where minutes count.
Okay. And when that call is made, setting up the landing zone, the LZ, it's on the ground crew, and the protocols sound incredibly specific.
They have to be. Safety is paramount. You need a minimum clear area, usually 60 feet by 60 feet, though bigger is better, especially at night. The surface needs to be level, firm hard ground, or short grass, and it must be cleared of all loose debris. Anything the rotor wash could kick up, branches, trash, rocks, is a danger. Overhead hazards like power lines or tall trees need to be identified too. And the zone itself needs marking, usually with weighted cones or maybe emergency vehicles positioned carefully.
Okay, this is where it gets really detailed in the sources, the LZ safety rules for the people on the ground. It sounds like you don't just run up to the helicopter.
Absolutely not. Ground crew must be trained on LZ procedures. You only approach the aircraft when the flight crew signals it's safe. Always stay well clear when the rotors are turning. We call that a hot aircraft. And the approach itself is critical. Always from the front, in the pilot's field of vision. Think of it like a clock face on the helicopter you approach between the 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock positions. Never, ever approach from the rear near the tail rotor.
Because the tail rotor is almost invisible when spinning, right?
Exactly, and it's dangerously low. Other key rules. Walk crouched when approaching under the main rotors, especially on uneven ground. At night, never shine lights up towards the helicopter. It blinds the pilot. Point beams down to light the LZ. If it's a HAZ mat scene, the LZ must be uphill and upwind. And any contaminated patients must be decontaminated before being loaded. That's non-negotiable. And basic fire safety. No smoking, no flares, no open flames. Anywhere near the aircraft standard is within 50 feet, about 15 meters.
Wow. We've really gone end to end today. From those 1970s KKK design standards and the basic 4S's for making sure a truck is ready, all the way to the incredibly fine-grained safety protocols for landing a helicopter in a field. And underlying it all is just this immense weight of responsibility on the operator.
It really is the key takeaway, isn't it? The whole system, from the dispatchers doing SSM, to the crews checking the rigs, to the pilot navigating to a tiny LZ, relies on meticulous planning and incredibly disciplined behavior. And these professionals operate knowing that, yes, they have some legal privileges, but that never, ever replaces their personal liability or the absolute need for caution and that constant due regard.
You know, we learned that just driving faster and faster often isn't the answer. It's actually dangerous during transport, yet the whole system feels geared towards cutting down response times. So here's something to think about. That psychological tension for drivers. Balancing the public perception of urgency, the lights, the noise, with the hard reality of physics, safety, and their own liability. What other systems or technologies could help reduce the need for that high-speed, high-risk driving? Maybe smarter traffic light integration, better predictive deployment. How can we save lives without putting rescuers and the public at such high risk on the roads? Something to mull over.